Hello, and welcome to the Degree of Freedom podcast. My name is Jonathan Haber, and today we're going to be joined by a very special guest, Sanjay Sarma, professor of mechanical engineering at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and MIT's first director of digital learning. In addition to working with the leaders of established MIT programs such as the Open Courseware Initiative, Professor Sarma is also responsible for finding ways to integrate the edX online learning platform, as well as content created by MITx into the wider campus learning experience. When most of us think of MOOCs, we think of their public face, notably the edX or Coursera Udacity websites where you can scan through a course catalog, sign up to take a class, and visit and revisit the site to watch video lessons, review a syllabus, or take an assessment. But the technology behind those online courses is neither single-purpose nor static. Rather, it constitutes a living, growing platform that is being used to power other learning initiatives. For instance, the edX learning management software, which was recently made open source, will power a just-announced partnership between edX and Google called MOOC.org that will allow the public to not just take, but also make and distribute their own online courses. And if someone asks you which online learning application is used more than any other inside the walls of MIT, make sure you answer edX. Similarly, while the content being delivered via this technology seems like a single integrated package of lectures, assessments, assignments, and all of the other materials making up a course to members of the public signing up to take a MOOC, some of the most interesting uses of this content derive from how it's being used after being disaggregated and integrated into live classroom instruction. The flipped classroom is a phrase that gets thrown around a lot these days, implying a teaching strategy that involves students listening to lectures as homework, which allows them to do other things, like take part in more complex projects or group discussions when they gather together in class. And having a professor's entire set of lectures recorded into bite-sized modules allows them to flip as much or as little of their course as they like. And professors need not rely on just the materials they generate themselves when they decide to reconfigure how their classes are taught. For all those content licensing deals which have made headlines over the last year, most of them involving state or international university systems paying for content from the major MOOC providers, are meant to give educators the option to tap into this third-party content as they think about what they want to include in their own online or flipped classes. MIT's Office of Digital Learning was designed to both construct and navigate a complicated, intersecting, and fast-changing roadmap linking teaching and technology for the benefit of MIT's residential students, as well as those of us not fortunate enough to attend the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. So let's hear what the man chosen to lead this initiative has to say about where MOOCs and other forms of free learning might be going. Sanjay Sarma, welcome to Degree of Freedom.
Good to talk to you, Jonathan.
So, Sanjay, can you describe your role as MIT's Director of Digital Learning and explain your relationship with initiatives such as edX, MITx, and the Open Courseware Initiative?
Sure. First of all, I should clarify the difference between edX and MITx. Think of edX as the movie multiplex. And what we do at MIT through MITx is we create the movies, that is, the MOOCs. So we are like Disney and they're like AMC. Within MIT, I have three roles. First, I'm the director of the new Office of Digital Learning, and I have MITx as a part of it, but also OCW, which is Open Courseware, which is a historic MIT program in open education resources, OEIT, which is essentially EdTech, and AMPS, which is Academic Media Production Services, which is essentially VidBill. I also serve on the board of edX, so I, along with other senior MIT professors and staff, represent the interests of MIT in the board of edX. I have two other roles. The second role is that in addition to producing movies for the world, perhaps more importantly than that, I'm tasked with creating content that can be used to transform education on campus. And that takes up a lot of my time. It's a very exciting role. And my third role is I also happen to chair an institute-wide task force along with our treasurer on reinventing MIT.
And most Degree of Freedom readers and listeners will be familiar with the public faces of programs like edX, but as you mentioned, you've been tasked to integrate these efforts into the MIT campus experience. Can you talk about what's been involved with that?
Yeah, teaching on campus hasn't changed much in 1,000 years. And MIT origins go back to changing that, actually. And the change that MIT introduced when it was founded was mens et manus, mind and hand, learning by doing. Now, we want to amp it up and take it to the next level. And so what we want to do, or what we're already doing, is taking content that we have made digital, and we're using that to flip our classrooms and create more engaging learning environments. So our students spend less time listening to professors give the same lecture that, you know, they gave last year, and more time working with professors, with each other, with staff, with TAs, discussing, building, and so on. And our figures right now is we have more than 1,600 students at MIT, and remember, we're a small campus, we have only 11,000 students, give or take, who already touch the edX platform purely through their classes. And what professors are doing is using the platform to flip the classroom and create a blended learning environment. And that's a lot of work. The good news is that there is a deep and long-term yearning within MIT amongst our faculty to do precisely this, which is to do fun stuff with their students. So initially, our growth has been organic, which is that a lot of professors have come to us. We've been done much selling and organically taken advantage of this platform. So this first 1,600 was pretty organic. Now, over time, though, we will have to reach out to more colleagues and convince them that this works, introduce them to other colleagues who've already done it, and try and spread the message. So we're in the midst of that now. It's a silent revolution. We're very excited by it, but it is happening.
And given these sort of dual missions, how do you balance MIT's internal needs with the mission to share resources with those who don't go to MIT?
It's kind of odd. They might seem diametrically opposite, but they're actually surprisingly aligned. If we're going to put a class online so that it can be used on campus, then yes, there is a fair bit of effort involved in putting it online for the rest of the world, but it isn't twice the effort. It's actually less than twice the effort. So the two missions are two sides of the same coin, if you will. By getting more and more universities to buy into this through edX, we're building a shared platform which is open source that can serve all our missions while also helping students around the world who need access to this, who'd like to access it, and so on. But primarily, in doing so, we're creating content that we want to use on campus. So it's a synergy, a resonance, if you will.
Speaking of on campus, you've written about the magic that happens within a residential college. Can you talk about what that consists of?
You know, many of your readers and listeners will have watched Harry Potter and know of the mythical world of Hogwarts, where all sorts of wonderful magical things happen. And that's a bit of a lyrical comparison, but things like that happen in real universities. You know, a student takes a class, she's really excited by what the professor said, she's walking through the halls, she bumps into another student who just took another class, they have an idea, they walk into the professor's office, they talk to him about it, he says, well, you know, try this, they go to the shop, they try it, and then they're in the evening, they're involved in some sports, they realize that this idea could actually apply in their sports. I mean, it's amazing how many social synaptic connections occur on campus. And it's amazing how having these wonderful, intelligent, young, vibrant minds together with professors who are world-renowned in their field, staff, coaches, how it creates an environment which is actually surprisingly hard to measure except to look at the Alps and to see people like Drew Houston or, you know, Kofi Annan or, you know, Bibi Netanyahu come out of places like MIT. So what I'm saying is that there is a extraordinary amount of stuff that we take for granted that happens on campus. We're now beginning to understand the magnitude of it. And if we are able to take lecturing, which is a form of instruction as opposed to learning necessarily, it's training, right, where you convey information mostly in a one-way fashion. If you can take that and do much of that, not all of it online, research that shows that online education works pretty well, so students then get this instruction online, then what you can do as a university is take the magic and really take it to a whole new level. And that is what really excites me. And I use the word magic on purpose. The reason is most of the attention of the academic world, the learning science world has been on the formal methods of information transfer in any lecture. But we're all realizing now that the informal methods, it's kind of like epigenetics, the informal channels are perhaps more important, and that's where certain maturation, certain insights occur, and we need to enhance that to a whole new level. We also need to give our students skills and competencies, which you can only give to some extent through instruction. But when you have a discussion, when you can test each other's ideas, when you can push back, when you can learn to disagree, that's when the next level, the metacognition, deep learning as opposed to the surface learning occurs. So I refer to all of that collectively as magic. And I use that fanciful term because it is something we will define more and more in the years to come.
We actually had one of your students as a guest here recently, Ethan Solomon, who I met at your Link conference, and he has brought his skills both as a MIT student with some science background and his journalism experience as editor of the Tech to an analysis of MOOCs, which he took on as a summer journalism project to do his own little mini degree of freedom project. And he was one of many students on that panel who really kind of reflected that creativity that goes beyond the classroom you're talking about.
Yeah, it is one of those things that challenges words. You cannot convey it. You can describe it, and you know, can describe it in a fanciful way. But when you actually experienced it, and many of your listeners will have experienced it in college, but then at a place like MIT, it's extremely intense. And that's where the creative juices really start to flow, and students, faculty, everyone, all of us, we recognize the special place that we have created, this tool of serendipity and invention. So anyway, that's why we refer to it as magic.
Out of curiosity, do you see some of the technical innovations that, not just within edX and other MOOC providers, but all the things going on at EdTech, do you see those ever being able to close some of the gaps between the virtual and on-campus learning experience you describe?
We're going to try, but you know, it's going to be an arms race. The campus experience will always have an advantage because the bandwidth of human communication, interpersonal communication, is pretty extraordinary. I think we're some ways away from doing that. The thing about massive open online courseware is I see it as the tip of an iceberg, and the rest of the iceberg is the bundle of digital learning tools that we've developed over 20 years. And one manifestation of one configuration of those tools is massive open online courseware. But really, those tools used individually, and they're these extraordinary things for enhancing the magic of residential. But will they replace residential? I actually don't think so. In fact, if anything, my view is these tools will actually save residential education. You know, there's a lot of discussion about costs and so on. There's a lot of discussion about how effective is it. Now, I'd say, you know, there's a numerator and a denominator. The denominator is not the money you invest, and the numerator is the amount of value you get out of a degree. Now, you can figure out where you want to go, you know, whether you want to focus on the denominator or numerator. But I'm very numerator-based. And digital learning tools can pretty fundamentally increase the value that students get out of the residential experience by taking the magic of residential experience and really magnifying it. So I think that this technology can actually save residential education, not the other way around. I don't think it'll hurt it or compete with it.
Getting back to the external MOOC experience, it's sort of astounding how rapidly this MOOC phenomenon developed. I know edX is just over a year old. What would you say is the most significant lesson learned so far?
Well, it's hard to pick out one lesson, but one thing we've learned that I'm astonished and humbled by is the impact it's having on people worldwide. You know, it seems like a theoretical exercise, but I know you, John, have actually taken a lot of these classes. But in terms of, you know, students in America, around the world, the deep impact Dr. Lewin's lectures have had on their appreciation of physics, on their, in seeing not just physics, but his gusto for life, and the emails they sent to us, the letters they sent to us, it's very moving. And so I read them literally every day because it reminds me that this isn't just some sort of experiment. There are real people who have really benefited from it, and I have no doubt they've benefited from it. Now, having said that, I will also say that, as with any technology, MOOCs over time will evolve their own pop culture. There'll be, you know, new habits that are formed, new communities, new ecosystems to take advantage of MOOCs. And, you know, who knows? When I was growing up in India, I went to a training school to study for the IIT, the Ministry of Technology. Maybe the new training schools will be based informally around MOOCs. So there are all these incredible new subcultures that will have to form and habits we'll have to learn and so on. We're very much in the early days of that. So that's my other takeaway. It'll be about 3 or 4 years before some of these subcultures take shape. Now, I use the analogy of eBay. When eBay was launched, it was just a few people selling, you know, their old vacuum cleaners or their old computers. But over the years, eBay has evolved into this vibrant community with people whose lives are based on it, their whole business model based on it, and so on. And there are also the subcultures and rating systems and trust models and so on. And so MOOCs will go down that path, and I think it'll take 2 or 3 years, but we're already seeing some of that happen.
Speaking of looking ahead, if you were to hazard a prediction regarding what the edX and the MIT campus experience might be in 5 or 10 years, what would be your best guess as to what these two institutions will end up looking like?
Well, I suspect what will happen is the changes will come subtly, but over time they will become very significant. I don't think lectures will go away. I think there will still be lectures. But there will be more and more self-service models. So, for example, I might imagine that in my class on manufacturing, I might give two lectures in the beginning of the semester, and then I might say to students, here are 30 widgets. I want you to figure out how to make them. And here are 25 modules. And I want you to consume these modules of online content with assessment and so on an as-needed basis. So, for example, I might give you a toothbrush, and you feel there's plastic, and you say, well, this is injection molded. I need to learn about injection molding. So you go consume the module on injection molding, and there might be links to videos submitted by industry, contributed on different new injection molding processes and so on. And then this other piece is camped, so I need to learn about sheet metal forming. And so they consume these online modules. Meanwhile, the next 2 weeks, the lectures are replaced with discussion sessions, where students come up and show their dissected toothbrushes or whatever parts I give them, and we analyze them. I go through the physics in a more interactive way. Some of the physics is online, but I go through in a more interactive way. I show the connections, and I bring in a guest speaker. And then the fourth week, we might actually go injection mold our own toothbrushes. MIT's always been very good at hands-on, so we already teach them injection molding, but now it's put in the context of something they want to do and something they've learned. Or maybe they want to modify the toothbrush and, invent a new type of toothbrush, and so on. So what happens is, in my class, I'm just using this as an example, then the class might go from 15 weeks of lectures to probably 6 weeks of lectures, lots of online modules, but a lot more creative problem-solving projects and so on, more of a studio with an output presentation that they make, not just to me, but perhaps captured in the online modules themselves and presented to the world. The final thing is, perhaps my class might be taught not just to my students, but to anyone around the world who wants to take it. And so now we crowdsource through the blog, feedback, and someone says, no, that toothbrush, it wasn't just injection molding, it was decorative injection molding. So it's a much more dynamic way of teaching. It's actually in some ways challenging for the professor, but oh my God, I mean, the output could be so different for both the students and for me.
Well, Sanjay, as always, it's a pleasure talking to you, and I wish you the best of luck with everything you're doing.
Duncan, pleasure. Great to talk to you, and look forward to seeing you again soon.
That was Sanjay Sarma, MIT's Director of Digital Learning. And before calling it a day on this week's podcast, I'd like to reflect on why both MOOCs and their spin-offs have generated so much enthusiasm and so much controversy among educators. As I've talked about frequently on the degreeoffreedom.org website, the time when a student might be able to MOOC his or her way to a formal, universally recognized college diploma is still a long way off. By the end of this year, I'll be able to tell you if it's possible to learn the equivalent of what you'd get from being enrolled in a four-year BA program using only MOOCs and other forms of free learning. But I can tell you right now that the set of steps someone would need to take to turn those independent learning activities into formal college credit, adding up to a degree from an established university, are so complex and onerous that only the most entrepreneurial student would be able to navigate them. And even such an enterprising student would have to pay a fair amount of money just to shave a year or two off a residential four-year degree program. In fact, despite all this talk about MOOCs as an alternative to brick-and-mortar colleges, their emergence has led to considerable reflection of what makes a residential college experience special. Today's guest has written and spoken about the magic of the campus, stressing all the things you get out of being surrounded by fellow students in an intense learning environment versus the somewhat isolated experience of remote online learning. And I think there's been a growing consensus that wherever MOOCs may lead us, residential colleges will still be there when we arrive. But that doesn't mean that the experiences students have at those residential colleges will be the same as the ones we had, or even last year's graduates had. For flipping the classroom has become shorthand for integrating a whole host of online assets into a college course in ways that transform when, where, and how a teacher stuffs material into a student's head, as well as the experience and expectations placed on that student. It was interesting to note that when professors at a California university revolted against the licensing of MOOC content by their administration, they didn't claim that the old way of doing things were just fine, thank you very much. Rather, they highlighted their own enthusiasm for flipped classrooms and other forms of technology-driven learning and expressed dismay that licensing prepackaged course content from someone like edX might short-circuit their own experiments in redesigning education. Now, would we be having these same conversations about the magic of the residential college or the flipped classrooms absent the MOOC phenomena capturing the public's imagination over the last couple of years? Probably, but most likely they would be the stuff discussed at endless interdisciplinary academic committee meetings that tend to proceed with a decided lack of urgency. So even if MOOCs don't end up putting anybody out of work, their very existence has accelerated the speed at which every educator's job is likely to change in the coming months and years versus decades or centuries. And with that, it's time to sign off. But I hope you'll be able to join us soon on the next Degree of Freedom podcast.